Hello and welcome to Byline from WFPL News. I'm Gabe Bullard in for Rick Howlett. Our top story today is the Kentucky Department of Education has released the long-awaited results of its new accountability system. They released the results overnight. Commissioner Terry Holliday says the results aren't as bad as the department estimated, but because the new model is more rigorous, the number of students deemed proficient is significantly less than what we're used to seeing. In Jefferson County Public Schools, around 40% of students are proficient in math and reading. Less than half of the students graduating from JCPS are college and career ready, but the district has improved since last year. WFPL's Devin Katayama sat down with Superintendent Donna Hargens, who says now that the benchmark has been set, it'll be up to good leadership in the classrooms and at the schools to improve the results.
Now, the number of students that were deemed proficient under the new accountability system did drop. We were all expecting them to drop. They dropped significantly. In JCPS, around 40% of the students here are proficient in math and reading. For students who were proficient before and now they're not, are they going to see a change in the way they're taught? Are they going to have extra interventions or extra time in class to work on those skills?
Absolutely. If students aren't proficient or distinguished, that is exactly the plan. Is there are systems and structures in place in the school to actually provide students individual time over what they need to learn.
Now, how will that work? Because 60% of students are not proficient in reading and math. So that's a large portion of the class.
Well, and what's important to remember is that the Common Core is about building a foundation, K-12. So each grade level now knows, per the Common Core, what it is students are expected to learn. So we've got some students, because the Common Core is new last year, that are missing rungs on that ladder, if you will. But what we know is that every year that's going to get better, because every year students will come to the next grade level more prepared for the work. So it will be building. But right now we're filling in gaps for students.
Now, elementary schools and middle schools generally ranked lower in proficiency. The high schools actually brought that proficiency level up for the district as a whole. What's happening between the middle schools and elementary schools and the high school level?
Well, what Dr. Hensley, our chief academic officer, is doing is putting systems and structures in place in all of our schools. I really think what the high schools did prior to other schools, they really did a great job of looking at data and doing something called Project Proficiency. So they were already working the system, but now all of our schools are working in professional learning communities, looking at the data, planning interventions for students. We all remember in our experience that thing we didn't get the first time, and sometimes you have to go over it again, and maybe sometimes a third time to get it. But there's no question that we all got it eventually. So that's what we need to provide for our students.
Now, how aggressive are these interventions going to be? Are they going to be just, here's another worksheet, just finish this worksheet, bring it back? Or is this going to actually be, Mary, can I see you for a second? We'll step out of class and maybe work on it one-on-one?
It's actually a structure within the school and the schedule. I visited middle school yesterday, and they're inside the structure of their school is a schedule for intervention time. So there were a group of students, all who didn't get a particular math concept, together working with a teacher at the smart board, figuring out how to do that problem. So it really is very deliberate and very intentional, but it's about the structure of the school. And then, of course, after school, we have places called learning places that students can get extra time around reading and math. We started that in February, giving students extra time, and students have done a remarkable job. So it's really about time around the things that you don't know.
The high schools ranked above the state average on achievement, gap, and growth, which, that's all excellent. The college and career readiness, they didn't do so well on. Where are the interventions going to come for that? I know that's based on the ACT tests for high schools and certifications, depending on what the school is, but how do you address that issue?
Well, actually, we had a nice increase in college and career readiness, but we really know that it's about all of our kids being college and career ready, so it's not acceptable to have less than half of our our kids being college and career ready. But really, the ACT is the benchmark for college and career readiness, and there are some other ways to demonstrate that. But you really have to have the foundational skills of being able to read well and do math well to be able to do well on the ACT.
The new accountability system also includes these new labels. Some of the labels are just relabeling, like the priority labels is what we formerly knew as persistently low-achieving schools. A new label that we're seeing is these focus schools, and I think I'm under the impression that focus schools are schools that could be successful in their ranking overall, but maybe have a specific group, like a minority group or English language learner group, that might need that extra little bit of help. For example, Ballard and Butler both rank in the 80th percentile among state schools, but they are in this focus school group. How are those schools going to address those specific issues?
Well, every school has an individual plan in place. What this data does is help inform and focus the school's efforts on the individual students. Remember, when we look at this data, we look at a big picture. When schools are devouring this data, they're seeing the data as students. So they can really look at it at the student level and see what it means for students and which groups of students didn't do well.
What are some schools that you've seen that have stepped up and made some major changes, or maybe the past few months since they've been looking at this data, or maybe the past year? What have you been seeing?
Well, and I really see it. I see it more consistently through all of our schools. We have achievement area superintendents who are working with a smaller number of schools with a ratio of 1 to 22. They're in schools all the time. So I would say our schools, what I see evidence of is our schools in August started with a plan and a structure in place to provide this extra time and support. They began with a structure of working in professional learning communities. So we certainly didn't wait for the scores and then say, what plan will we have? Plans were certainly in place. The foundation was in place. Dr. Hensley has repositioned lots of resources that used to be at central office directly into schools so that they have the support network. Now this data helps us inform the specifics of it.
I asked you this question when you were here earlier this year for the Back to School special, but I want to know if your answer has changed. The five categories that we're looking at in this new accountability system are all very important, but I'm wondering now that you've taken a look at some of this data, whether your answer has changed, whether there's one that really sticks out to you. For example, for me, when I look at the graduation rate, when you look at some of the other data, we're either only slightly below the state average or in some cases above the state average or meeting that mark. Is the graduation rate something to be really concerned about? Because that's the end result of a student getting out of the public school system.
Well, we certainly want all JCPS students to graduate prepared. So I don't think you can say you can graduate, but we don't want you to graduate and then have to take a remediation class when you go on to the next level. So I don't know that you can isolate one as being important. They all work together. And as you pointed out, a particular school might be doing really well just on proficiency, but something's getting lost if you don't look at growth and gap. Growth is about every student learning more and growing. So even if a student is proficient, they still need to be growing academically. So you have to look at that piece also. So I think Kentucky with the new accountability system has done a great job of the five pieces, and you can't afford to ignore any one of those pieces.
What will significant growth look like? I know it's going to vary between school and even between districts, but we have these miniature goals set out in the new accountability system. Some schools need to make, 0.5% more progress. Others need to make more significant progress. Is that what we should be looking at as the goals, or should we be shooting higher, or can we expect maybe it for the achievement not to move that quickly? In your heart, what do you feel like is the correct answer?
Well, we know that this is going to take hard work and persistence over time, but what we would hope to see as we do this deliberate effort is what I call arrows going in the right direction. So whatever score an individual school had in each one of those areas, we would expect that they go up to some degree. And overall, again, it's going to be the individual efforts of teachers and the individual success of students that is going to help the needle overall in Jefferson County move forward and where it needs to be. So it really starts at that level. But we would hope to see arrows going in the right direction for all of our schools.
And when will parents learn where their student ranks among their peers? When do they get their kind of quote-unquote report card?
Well, as soon as we get the reports, we will mail them to parents. That's a board policy. And then they will see how their individual student did. So as soon as we get them, so it may take several weeks, but as soon as we get them, we're going to put them right in the mail. And then we'll provide opportunities for parents to ask questions. And that's a really important information because it says where your child is on this journey to be truly college and career ready. And as a parent, you want to know that. And you want to know that, yes, they can do it, but they may need to have extra time and support to do it.
Ms. Hargens, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure, always.
It's Byline on WFPL. On Monday, we woke up to news that a train had derailed in southwest Jefferson County. The accident quickly turned into a chemical spill as an entire carload of the flammable chemical butadiene leaked. On Wednesday, it ignited, leaving three workers hospitalized, and the fire is still going on in a controlled burn. With us to get the latest are Erica Peterson and Joseph Lord from the WFPL Newsroom. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Gabe.
Thanks, Gabe.
So what is the situation now?
At this moment, the fire is still burning, but it's controlled. The firefighter or the emergency crews are going to be working today to move some of the cars around so they can get access to the hydrogen fluoride cars, which are causing them the most concern.
And hydrogen fluoride is a pretty dangerous chemical.
Yeah, these hydrogen fluoride cars are actually at the bottom of a pile of train cars right now. And hydrogen fluoride is an odorless gas that basically attacks mucous membranes, so it can cause severe burns to really delicate parts of the body like eyes and lungs. So it's a huge concern that this gas not get out.
And this is also, it turns into hydrofluoric acid if combined with water, moisture on skin.
That's what does the damage.
And what is the level then of environmental contamination from this accident? We saw that whole car butadiene leaked. What, styrene also leaked?
Yeah, regulators are saying there's no doubt this is a contaminated site, but they've done testing. They found that there's really no air contamination outside of the footprint of the accident right now. They've been testing for volatile organic compounds or VOCs. So air monitoring has not shown any spread of that butadiene or styrene. They've also done water testing in both the Salt River and the Ohio and not found high levels. One of the concerns, though, is they've been using a lot of water to fight the fire. So they've been pouring, you know, gallons and gallons and gallons of water on this thing, and the water is, you know, then presumably contaminated. So they're working right now to actually pump some of that out and contain it so it doesn't cause any more contamination.
And what's the risk to the river, since when you look at this accident, it is right next to the Ohio?
Well, there definitely is a risk, but right now they're saying they aren't sure what the risk is. And on the river, at least the Ohio River, is so big, it could very easily become diluted. So the contamination would have to be pretty severe to cause harm.
And Joe, quickly, this is a P&L railway line, and they've set up something for people who have been displaced.
Right. People who have been displaced, people who have incurred costs from food or lodging, people whose businesses have been affected. There is an outreach center that's open from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily at the VFW Post 1181, which is located at 6518 Blevins Gap Road.
All right, and we'll have the latest information on the website as well, WFPL.org. Check for the live blog. You two are running there. Joseph Lord, Erica Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And you're listening to Byline. We'll be back in one moment with a look at the profits, or lack thereof, from 4th Street Live, and a look ahead to the elections. It's Byline from WFPL News. I'm Gabe Bullard in for Rick Howlett. Just about two blocks up from our studios here is 4th Street Live. It's a commercial and entertainment district in downtown Louisville. It's been the subject of criticism for many reasons. A New York Times travel piece called it frat-tastic, overwrought, and underthought. There have been allegations of racial discrimination within the businesses. There's also criticism that it's not local. It's mostly made up of chains, and it's run by the Cordish Companies, a Baltimore-based developer. And now a report in the Courier-Journal says the district isn't profitable, at least not to the city per se. After nearly 8 years in operation, 4th Street Live hasn't made enough money to pay the city any dividends. Chris Ottz wrote that piece for the Courier. He's here now. Chris, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, thank you, Gabe.
So why hasn't Cordish paid the city any dividends?
Well, there's potentially two reasons. One is that Cordish is not making any money at 4th Street Live. The second reason is that maybe they are making money by the traditional standards of how you measure profit, but the profit-sharing agreement that the city has that dates back to 2001 with Cordish is structured in such a way that Cordish can keep money from the development without actually showing a profit according to the terms of that agreement.
Right. There's a quote in your story where you say this agreement for profit sharing from 4th Street Live defines profit in a very favorable way for Cordish.
Yes, it does. It is really, really tough accounting stuff. I mean, there's the whole page, it seems like, the definition of modified net operating profit in this agreement and net operating profit. But the point is there are all sorts of unconventional things in there, according to the corporate finance expert that I consulted for the story, that would allow them to essentially take cash out, and it could potentially be profitable even without showing a profit on these profit and loss statements. One example that's real easy to understand is that they get to keep 5% of the revenue right off the top before you even get to calculate profit.
So 5%, that's going back to Cordish most likely.
Right.
And you're right. Would Cordish even be doing this if they weren't turning a profit for at least themselves?
Well, that was, Assistant Economic Development Director at the city, David Morris, that was the quote that he gave me, that presumably this is a good business venture for them or else they wouldn't continue to operate it after 8 years. The statement that I got from Cordish really was kind of, non-committal on or not very clear on. They said that it's only been 8 years, so it's not possible to determine the financial returns of 4th Street Live, and they reiterated that they are committed to Louisville and into this business venture for the long haul.
Maybe it's not possible to measure the returns, but we can measure how much the city has put into this.
Yes.
And how much has that been?
That is about $20 million, roughly. It's complicated because there's also state money involved. Those are sales tax rebates, which is under a state program to encourage tourist attraction developments like 4th Street Live. And then the city has a backstop for that. So in case Cordish doesn't have this, in case 4th Street Live, doesn't have the sales to take full advantage of the state tax credits, they have an escrow account with the city where they can claim money from that to make sure that they get the full financial benefit. So, to keep it quick, initially Cordish got about $13.5 million from the city to get the development going, and then there's this $3.5 million escrow account from the city, of which Cordish has drawn about, I think, $1.2 million, and they expect the city expects about $2 million of that to be used over the life of the agreement.
So is Cordish saying, they're saying that 8 years really isn't enough to start realizing this profit for the city, when might the city start to get a return on this?
Well, their statement was long, but it did not address that whatsoever, so no way to know.
Do you think that this shows that 4th Street Live is generally underwhelmed? There have been plans, I think, as long as I've lived in Louisville, for this expansion into the center city development, but how likely is that even to happen?
Well, the short answer is I haven't really looked into that, there's not been much activity to, lately on that center city development. And what this shows about 4th Street Live, I think, is really, it's hard to tell. Is it really profitable, and the agreement is just such that, that Cordish can not really show a profit on these financial statements according to these terms, or is it not profitable at all? I mean, the central question of the story says that we don't know.
And still a lot of questions. I'm sure that you're out there asking them and hoping to get the answers. We'll link to the piece in the show notes as well. Chris Hotz, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you, Gabe.
All right. And now we are in the studio. I'm here with our political editor, Philip Bailey, and our Frankfurt Bureau chief, Kenny Colston. You guys want to talk about the elections?
What's going on? The election?
Something going on Tuesday, I think.
Okay, I don't know where I'll be about that.
Elections on many levels. Kenny, I want to start with you. We don't have any statewide races on the ballot like we've seen before. You know, there's not a Senate contest. Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul aren't up for re-election. There's not a gubernatorial race, attorney general, no statewide offices. But there are legislative races across the state, and we've seen the Republican Party hoping to get a majority in the state House of Representatives.
That's exactly right. Since there are no statewide races, it kind of limits what the money and the attention can go to. And so Republicans need a net of 10 seats on Tuesday in order to take control of the state house. That's been their goal all along as an entire party. And, you know, there's some debate on whether they're going to get to that because 10 seats is a lot of seats. Democrats are attacking them in certain areas, notably here in Louisville with Mike Nemes in South Louisville. But Republicans are also doing the same thing, attacking some Democratic incumbents. And so what's going on is basically there's outside groups as well. You've got the Kentucky Family Values Super PAC for Democrats. They've dumped almost $500,000 into these races, which usually these races, like if you raise $30,000, you have a lot of money. So dropping $500,000 into a dozen of these races, maybe two dozen, that's a lot of money. And now it looks like an outside Republican group, the Republican State Leadership Committee, has now jumped into the six figures with their ad buy as well. I'm not sure if it's close to that $500,000, but it's definitely got a couple of zeros behind it.
Is this part of the new normal for statewide campaigns, you think, bringing in these outside groups as long as they remain legal?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that with the gubernatorial race last year. That's where Kentucky Family Values got their start. There was even outside groups in 2010. American Crossroads helped Rand Paul in his U.S. Senate victory. So, yeah, we're in the age of super PACs when it comes to politics. They're not going away until the Supreme Court changes their Citizens United decision. And as the court sits now, that's not possible. So, yeah, you're going to have outside groups that are probably going to, you know, control the messaging almost more than the candidates themselves. It doesn't make a lot of the political insiders happy because they lose their messaging. But the fact of the matter is their money is priceless, and who knows?
And there's also a constitutional amendment on the ballot now that would secure hunting and fishing rights, right?
That's correct. Basically, this amendment to the Kentucky Constitution, and there's really no threat to this that anyone is aware of. Even kind of supporters of this will say, well, there's no current threat to hunting and fishing rights. But that being said, they wanted to go ahead and put it on the ballot anyways, because who knows when this threat will come along and steal hunting and fishing rights. No one's really opposing it, not even Kentuckians for the Commonwealth or other groups. But it's going to pass anyway, so it'll be part of the conversation after Tuesday. It'll be an amendment to the Constitution.
House Speaker Greg Stumbo, a Democrat, is a supporter of this, but is it odd that he would agree to this, given that it's a close election and this seems like it could be bringing out more conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, that is odd that in an election like this, you are going to have you basically have an amendment that's going to bring a lot of hunters and fishers out. Those people tend to be more conservative. But at the same time, in Kentucky, as you know, the Kentucky Democratic Party, there's a lot of conservatives anyways. So their thought is maybe in West and East Kentucky, we can get these conservative Democrats out to the ballot. They may not vote for President Obama, but they might vote for us. Sometimes people say that there's a little bit of Democratic guilt in Western Eastern Kentucky. They'll go vote for the Republican in a federal race, but they'll feel so guilty about it because they're Democrats, they'll go down the line and check every other Democrat. So maybe there's a little of that happening.
And there are some federal races going on, three exactly, that are pretty exciting right now that are at least being closely watched for the House of Representatives, the U.S. House. You've been covering the 6th District quite a bit.
Yeah, Kentucky's 6th Congressional District in Central Kentucky. Basically, you've got Congressman Ben Chandler, who's a Democrat, Republican Andy Barr. This is a rematch from 2010. Barr, in a surprise, only lost by less than 700 votes in 2010. He appears stronger this time around. There's no really independent polling, so we don't know what's going on in that race. But at the end of the day, it's probably going to be closer than it was in 2010. And, you know, in 2010, there was a re-canvass where basically they checked to make sure the numbers are right. I would guess in this time we might go to a recount, maybe even court battles.
And so we might not know on election night who's won in that contest.
You may not. I mean, Ben Chandler gained 2,000 Democrats in redistricting, but they're conservative Eastern Kentucky Democrats. There's no guarantee that they're going to vote for him. Chandler also has some problems with more of his liberal base in like Fayette County and Lexington, who say that Ben Chandler's basically a Republican. Why would we vote for him over Andy Barr? So he's got some problems on both flanks, and it'll just be interesting to see.
I remember during the primary, you were talking a lot about this fourth congressional district race, the GOP primary at least, and it doesn't seem like there's been much since Thomas Massie won the nomination.
No, a lot of Thomas Massie's campaign staff has moved on, transitioned back to basically U.S. Senator Rand Paul's staff or other initiatives. The Democrat Bill Atkins is trying his hardest, but basically that is the Republican heart in Kentucky, is Northern Kentucky, that fourth congressional district. And so Massie is acting as if, you know, it's a cakewalk, and it should be for him.
And, Philip, you've been covering the third district race here in Louisville between incumbent Democrat John Yarmuth and his challenger, Brooks Wicker.
Yeah, that race appears to be, I mean, at this point, we have a situation where Congressman Yarmuth's putting out one ad. He's only going to put out one ad in the race.
And it's a fairly upbeat ad.
It's a positive ad. It talks about how he supported the Affordable Care Act, which is something you don't see in these parts.
No.
You don't see Democrats running to what's called Obamacare, but Congressman Yarmuth is certainly something that he's proud of, and he's put it in his one and only ad. It's not really clear if Brooks Wicker will come out with an ad. This would be the time where if we were going to see a Brooks Wicker television ad, that he would buy one. There still isn't a buy. We've contacted the Wicker campaign to ask if they are going to buy one. The story of Mr. Wicker's campaign has been poor fundraising. Has he generated enough attention? So at this point, Congressman Yarmuth is considered the clear favorite. He won 2 years ago, by double digits. I think Nick, almost 20 points. So the question is, will he have an even bigger victory in 2012, or will it be, you know, less than? But everyone expects Congressman Yarmuth to win this race.
You see with incumbents after a few terms in the House that generally they start to be regarded a bit more as safe in their district. People who maybe opposed them when they were first running, their first few campaigns even, are starting to support them. The district sort of rallies behind their incumbents. Is that what you think is happening with Congressman Yarmuth?
I think that after 2008, when the congressman beat his the former congresswoman Ann Northup for the second time by a wider margin, and then when you had President Obama, and remember, Kentucky's third congressional district is unlike other congressional districts in Kentucky, the makeup of it, the basic demographics. You're talking about a congressional district in Kentucky that is about 20% African American, more urban district. There are some pretty liberal quarters of Kentucky 3 that you don't see in any other congressional district in Kentucky. Congressman Yarmuth decided, like many Democrats who were running to the center, he decided to run to the left. And Congressman Yarmuth has always been someone publicly who's known as a liberal. And he's someone who can pretty well defend those liberal positions. So in a city that's already 2-1 Democrat, that already has a makeup that other congressional districts in the state do not, when you have a popular president as far as Jefferson County is concerned, Obama has always won Jefferson County, even though he's getting trounced in Kentucky. Yarmuth has benefited from the Obama era, certainly.
And speaking of Jefferson County, we have a few Metro Council races up that are looking pretty interesting. One in the 18th district, where Marilyn Parker, big Tea Party Republican, unseated John Akerson in the primary. She's facing Teague Ridge now for the election.
For those who say that the Tea Party is dead, I think that the Metro Council District 18 race is a clear slap in the face to that. Marilyn Parker has run a fairly well-organized campaign. She's tried to even moderate her positions a little bit, not highlighted her Tea Party credentials as much in the general as she did during the primary, which is something you didn't see from Tea Party candidates. They usually ratcheted up mm-hmm. their Tea Party affiliation. She's done the opposite. So she is considered the favorite. Now, Mr. Ridge has come out with some campaign releases saying that, you know, Ms. Parker has unfairly attacked him in some of her mailers. There's a question of why Ms. Parker would even attack Ridge in a Republican-leaning district like the 18th district, which covers parts of St. Matthews and out in the East End in that area. So she's considered the favorite. And the one sign is that John Akerson has endorsed Teague Ridge, while all other Republicans on the council are behind Ms. Parker.
Well, and Councilman Akerson has, I think there are a few hard feelings there.
Oh, I think that's an understatement at this point.
Given that they supported Marilyn Parker in the primary
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
And in the 26th district, we're seeing Brent Akerson is starting to ratchet up some of his campaigning.
Perhaps maybe Brent Akerson, who's the son of Councilman John Akerson, he's a Democrat. He seems to be running a really, really vigorous campaign for a council race. I mean, usually council incumbents raise between $25,000 to $60,000. Brent Ackerson's raised close to $90,000, almost $90,000 in this race. Some pretty big names. And he's run, you know, some mailers out there highlighting what he's done for the district beautification project. He's also run some attack mailers, though, against Republican Sarah Provancher, saying that at one point in her life she lived the sin of living in Florida and Illinois, basically saying she's not a lifelong
resident. You know, I lived in Illinois, too, so.
And Missouri, too, so you're definitely not running for council anytime soon.
I'll have to repent.
Some saw that as a sort of a nativist attack. She says that's backfiring. She's lived in Louisville for 10 years. Ackerson said he's pointing that out only because it demonstrates that she doesn't know the lay of the land, lay of the district. She recently moved there about a year and a half ago. A
couple other races we're watching in the 14th district, Cindy Fowler and Bob Hughlin, and in the 8th district, incumbent Tom Owen facing a challenge from Kurt Jacobs.
For the 14th district, it's important because Democratic Councilman Bob Henderson's retiring. It's a seat that the Republicans think they can pick up. It'll give them a 10 to 16 minority instead of a 17 to 9. That's slightly important because that means the Democrats are two votes away from a veto-proof majority. In District 8, it seems that Councilman Tom Owens is going to run away with that. I mean, Kirk Jacobs running as Republican in District 8, which covers most of the Highlands, run a really, really energetic campaign. But many people say, well, your positions are very similar to Councilman Owens. You're running as a Republican, but under pretty much a Democratic platform. I don't really see the difference. Let me just stick with the guy I already have in office. Now, in District 14, it's not really clear. Cindy Fowler is Councilman Henderson's aide. She's gotten support from Joni Jenkins, State Representative Joni Jenkins, while Mr. Hughlin's got support from State Senate candidate Chris Thieneman.
We got about one more minute left, but I want to look north for a little while. There's a new poll out in the Richard Murdoch, Joe Donnelly race for the Senate.
Mr. Donnelly, Congressman Donnelly, according to this independent poll, is up by 11 points.
Does that have anything to do, you think, with these rape comments that Richard Murdoch had made?
Yeah, I mean, the pollsters certainly point that out, that those who heard the comments, 40% said they are less likely to vote for Mr. Murdoch as a result. This is a race that had been dead even up until that point. So Mr. Murdoch's comments, many pundits and observers are now pointing out maybe this was God's intention the entire time for him to be down 11 points 4 days before election.
And it seems like that came, much closer to the election than what we saw in Missouri with Todd Akin's comments, and he seems to have recovered slightly.
Because there's been some time since those comments. You know, he's gotten a little bit more, the gap is going to close. This doesn't mean that the election will necessarily be 11 points. Many still think it'll be 5 to 6 points that is the real gap here, but certainly didn't help Mr. Murdoch to have these comments 2 weeks before the election.
All right. Philip Bailey, Kenny Colston, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gabe.
And you could spend your election night with us here at WFPL News. We're going to have live coverage starting at 6, going throughout the night till everything is settled. So make sure to tune into that, 89.3, also online at WFPL.org. We'll have live blogs as well there. In October of 1912, a pulp magazine called The All Story published a story called Tarzan of the Apes, A Romance of the Jungle. The tale of an orphan child of British aristocracy who was raised by apes in the African jungle was the first of many involving the hero created by Edgar Rice Burroughs. And as WFPL's Rick Howlett reports, the University of Louisville has a prominent role in the centennial celebration and preserving the Tarzan legacy.
When George McWhorter was 5 years old, his mother decided that she would teach him how to read so he would be able to keep pace with other school children.
She first started with Charles Dickens, and I was totally disinterested and yawned right in her face. But when she pulled out a Tarzan book, I was all eyes and all ears.
And thus began George McWhorter's lifelong Tarzan fascination. In 1936, he started amassing a collection of first edition books and other memorabilia that has swelled to 200,000 items. McWhorter donated his collection in his mother's honor to the University of Louisville, where he's a longtime curator of rare books. Uvell says it's the largest institutional collection of Tarzan materials in the world. Now 82, McWhorter hosted a Tarzan 100th anniversary party at Uvell last month. The guests included Edgar Rice Burroughs' grandson, John, who also learned to read on the Tarzan books.
And I asked him, I says, Grandpa, how come you always leave the end of a book not completely finished? And he said, I always want the people that read my stuff and like it to want more.
Millions more have come to know Tarzan at the movies, most notably the films of the 1930s and 40s starring Johnny Weissmuller. John Burroughs says his grandfather didn't care much for most of the Tarzan film adaptations, which took some liberties with the character and the love of his life, Jane.
He was a literate English lord. Tarzan never said, me Tarzan, you Jane. That was a creation of MGM.
One thing Edgar Rice Burroughs did write about was the Tarzan yell, immortalized by Weissmuller.
The eel was an animal like the apes that had just made a kill or just finished a battle. They would pound their chest in exultation like, I'm the head of the pack, I'm the king.
MGM's sensational new young star, Denny Miller. His exploits of daring, a challenge to the taboos of a forbidden land.
Some two dozen actors have played Tarzan in films and television. Denny Miller was known as the first blonde Tarzan and as the oldest of the surviving actors. He played the Lord of the Jungle in 1959's Tarzan the Ape Man.
They had the rights to do two more, and I never heard from them since. I only did one, and it sure was fun.
While that film was not a big commercial success, Miller was able to parlay the experience into some similar work in TV and commercials, and these days he's taking an active part in the Tarzan Centennial. He calls Edgar Rice Burroughs one of the world's great storytellers.
The meeting will come to order.
At the Tarzan anniversary party at U of L, George McWhorter sets the mood for a panel discussion of Edgar Rice Burroughs and Tarzan, a franchise that continues to thrive in new ways. There's now a novel by Robin Maxwell called Jane, the Woman Who Loved Tarzan, the first version of the Tarzan story written by a woman. And work is underway on new animated and live-action Tarzan films. John Burroughs says he's glad to see Tarzan recognized more these days as an eco-warrior, a defender of the jungle from elephant poachers and protector of its trees, a trait his grandfather intended. But to him, there's a simpler reason the character has endured for a century.
He takes a person out of their humdrum normal life and brings them into a completely different, believable world where good triumphs over evil and the strong survive. And if something terrible and awful happened to you, you don't lie down and pray or feel sad for yourself. You get up and try again and make it work.
Rick Howlett, WFPL News.
And some of the items from the University of Louisville's Tarzan collection are on display through December 15th at U of L's Rare Books Department. The hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. It's free and open to the public. Even more information on WFPL.org. You're listening to Byline, and we'll take a look at the arts in 1 minute. It's Byline on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard, in for Rick Howlett. I'm here now with WFPL arts reporter Aaron Keene. Aaron, thanks for coming down.
Oh, thanks for having me, Gabe.
So Halloween is over. I'm still in my costume, and there's still something eerie and literary going on in Louisville.
Yeah, tonight is the closing night of An Evening with Poe at the Fraser History Museum. And I hear that the event is sold out, but you never know on a busy weekend. Maybe if you call ahead or if you show up, if some tickets go unclaimed, maybe they'll add some seats. Probably not. But if you missed An Evening with Poe this year, you should definitely try and make it again next year. Hopefully this is an every year event. This is the third year that they've done it. And what the historical interpreters at the Fraser do is they've staged some Edgar Allan Poe poems and stories. And there's some great musicians who are sort of play behind them. Sort of Appalachian-ish style old-time music. And it's a really cool evening, a really great theater, actually. And it's difficult to do to stage a poem or a short story, to adapt it for very short, brief moments on stage, but they do it quite well.
So this isn't really like that John Cusack movie that came out recently where he was playing Edgar Allan Poe solving mysteries.
Okay, so Tony Dingman, it's sort of his brainchild. He's one of the interpreters, and he would be clutching his cravat right about now. He said that. No, however, one of the stories that they staged is The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is one of the, it's sort of the prototype for the modern detective novel. I mean, it predates Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes and the whole deductive reasoning, solving the crime approach. Was actually Poe's. So, you know, you do get a little bit of that early detective novel, but there's no, they keep it very faithful to the text. It's a history museum.
Well, and speaking of history, 44 plays for 44 presidents.
Yes.
It's that time of the election cycle.
Yes. This is folks who caught it, the production about four years ago at Actors Theater when it was 43 plays for 44 presidents before the last election. This is a play written by the Neo-Futurists, a troupe out of Chicago. And this year, for this election year, they've staged a nationwide festival. So, you know, professional theaters, high school theaters, and everything in between, from San Jose, Little Rock, to New York, and here in Louisville, have all staged the same play. 44 plays for 44 presidents is each president gets 2 minutes, and it's all exhaustively researched, but then kind of put into this sausage grinder of absurdity and pathos and historical nerddom, song and dance numbers, that sort of thing. It's staged at the Bardstown and produced by the Bardstown Theater.
And something like 1776 in fast motion.
Yes, with every president, and with like a really sort of strangely weird, sometimes jaundiced, sometimes heroic look. Basically, the only two presidents who come out of this looking really, really good, spoiler alert, are George Washington, because he was starting from the beginning, and Teddy Roosevelt.
I remember seeing it 4 years ago and thinking that really punches aren't pulled for a lot of these presidents.
No, Eisenhower comes off surprisingly sinister. It's one of those plays that's going to make you reevaluate maybe what you were taught in history class and the perception that we have of some presidents. And then some presidents where you're like, oh yeah, he was a guy who led our nation for 4 or 8 years. What was his name again?
And also, moving on, there's a new theater, or a new production from a new theater company going on.
I love it when we get a new theater company opening here in Louisville, and it seems like it's happening more often.
We need like a bell to ring whenever there's a new one.
Yes, it does seem like it's happening more often lately, which is fantastic. This is called the Eve Theater Company, and as the name would suggest, they're a women's theater company. So they're dedicated to plays by women playwrights or staging productions directed by women with an all-female cast, perhaps, or predominantly female cast. Really, they're examining the women's perspectives on stage. And their first production is Nora and Delia Ephron's Love, Loss, and What I Wore, which is a collection of monologues that are all about, you know, using clothing as a metaphor for life stages and life changes. There's funny moments, there's poignant moments. It was a big hit in New York and has done a national tour. And, you know, we're talking about the screenwriters of movies like When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail. So it's one of those kinds of plays that's going to appeal to a lot, mostly women, but a lot of women across a lot of different age and demographic levels.
How does Eve compare to Looking for Lilith, the other all-female theater company in town?
That's a really good question. Looking for Lilith has a pretty, I mean, not unique. They're not the only theater company in the world that does this. But for Louisville, they're one of the small handful of companies that devises its own work. So while their last production was Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, for the most part, Lilith is dedicated to using this collaborative theater devising method to put together original plays that they then can either take on tour or reprise or just put into the repertoire. Eve Theater Company's so far seems like their outlook is going to be a little more traditional, in that they're looking for plays which are written and published by playwrights that they can then bring in stage here. So a little more, I guess, more of a traditional production company than a collaborative devising, creating company.
And so from that approach and from their mission, sort of a different place that they'll be carving out in the Louisville theater scene.
Yeah, so I think it really speaks well to our theater, the health of our artistic and theater community, that we don't just have one, you know, one theater company dedicated to women's perspectives, that this is a community that can support more. You don't have to just have one of everything, you know?
Right.
You can have more than one, and it sort of enriches and enlivens the discussion.
Well, speaking of theater, in the studio with us now are Teresa Willis and Allison Huff. We will pull back the curtain. They are respectively the festival director and the producer of the Slant Culture Theater Festival. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having
us. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
So this is a new festival this year, a new theater plus, theater and. There's more than theater going on in this festival, but when I first heard that this was going to be a thing that was going to happen, I heard it described by a friend kind of on the inside as, well, it's sort of like a fringe festival, but it's not a fringe festival. So can you start by telling us, what's a fringe festival and how does this differ?
A fringe festival is based on, in Edinburgh, Scotland, a festival developed around an international theater festival that's held in Edinburgh for years and years and years. And a local group tried to get in, and they wouldn't let them in. So they were, you know, they were rebels, and they created their own festival outside of the walls of the sacred, hallowed, you know, Edinburgh International Theater Festival called the Fringe Festival. And that was, I think, in the 50s. And since then, this format of small, scrappy theater companies coming in and creating theater in Edinburgh, they do it in doorways. I mean, anything is a theater space. Everything in Edinburgh in 3 weeks in August turns into a theater space. So that's a Fringe Festival. And that modality has moved over into the United States. Canada picked it up first, and now nearly every major city has, you know, New York, Los Angeles, Orlando, Indianapolis, Cincinnati. I mean, there's a fringe circuit that one can go on.
And this is now where a lot of plays are going to get their sort of first tryout before maybe getting a lot of producer attention, like Greg Kotis's You're in Town debuted at the New York Fringe Festival, and then bam, became a big Broadway hit later.
Exactly. So that's the modality. That is not what we're doing. This Land Culture Theater Festival is more local grown than that. Five theater companies, Walden Theater, La Petite Main, Theater 502, Louisville Improvisers, and the Savage Rose Classical Theater Company, came together and saw that they had a really similar audience demographic but didn't necessarily share audiences. Hmm. That perhaps wasn't an awareness that this pool of really great semi-professional theaters in this town was so rich. So they thought Allison and her colleagues at Walden came up with the idea of having a festival and invited those theater companies because they had very strong ties. Some of them are alumni, some of them share board members, that sort of thing, for this first year to just come together and see what we can produce. And so that's what we're doing.
So Allison is, as a representative of Walden Theater, which is a theater training and conservatory program for kids, what, like grades 5 through 12?
No, we actually start with kids as young as 5 years old.
Whoa.
Yeah, 5 to 18.
5 to 18.
We serve kids in schools, and then we have our conservatory program after school and in the summers.
And there is a Walden Theater production, Salvation Road, in the festival.
Yes.
But so how does bringing in all of these other theater groups sort of work within the Walden mission, and why did you guys decide to take this step into being festival producers as well?
Well, we really think that through collaboration, you know, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on in the Louisville theater community anyway, and there's so much overlap with staff and board members, and, you know, some audience members, you know, go to everything. But for the most part, our audiences are still in these silos. Mm-hmm. And we really think that we can, if we work together through this collaborative process, what we can create as a whole is greater than the sum of our parts. You know, so in addition to cross-pollinating our existing audiences and opening doors and relationships for the folks who are involved in the festival, to, you know, our kids at Walden included, you know, just to have access to some of these theater professionals in town is really awesome. But also to wrap it up in a festival package, add some local music and food trucks and a bar, and make it a lot of fun and a great and affordable entertainment option. And by wrapping it in that festival package, we hope to attract some folks who maybe aren't regular theater goers to come and take a chance on theater and realize that there's a lot of great shows going on in this town that are for them, you know, that we know that they'll love if they'll just come and check it out.
Louisville loves a festival. People will go to a festival for just about anything in this town, which is fantastic. We have a lot of them. So the Slant Culture Festival starts November 9th and runs through the 8th.
The 8th. It starts
the 8th and runs through the
18th.
Gotcha. So, and there are five different, as you mentioned, five different companies working, staging plays constantly throughout. So there'll be like two plays going on at once inside of Walden Theater, plus other events as well. And so I'm curious about the Squalus Puppeteers are an organization who are going to be doing some work there, Typecast Publishing, Shine, Art FM, the radio station. So how did you decide which partners then you were going to pull in who weren't these theater companies?
Well, just from a programming aspect, we wanted to look at who could bring something that we didn't have yet. Mm-hmm. So I have a spoken word background, so I went straight for the readings. You know, I really wanted to get a good like slam type show in there. And so we found Typecast, which is a great publication company right here in Louisville. And so they're producing a reading by one of their authors, Scuffletown.
Chris Mattingly.
Yes, exactly. and then The Kids Can All Write, which is affiliated with Generation I Speak, which is an organization that brings high school kids to poetry, basically. And these kids are great. Oh, my God, they're so good. Also, you know, Squalus is such a great choice for Walden. I mean, Squalus, everybody knows them. They're everywhere. And we wanted them here. I mean, they're such a good Louisville signature group. We wanted them to be a part of what we're doing. They're doing a workshop, a show, then a workshop. So it's called Food Fight, and it's about food and what to eat and all that. And so the families can bring their kids, and then everybody can get involved in something right after that.
Yeah, we have it set up on the weekend so that early in the day, it's very family friendly. You know, we want parents and kids and everybody to come out, have a burger, grind a food truck outside, and stick around for shows and workshops that you can do with your kids, interactive. You know, not just a passive audience experience, but you know, to be able to get your hands on puppet making and a Walden Theater workshop too. And then as the day progresses, you know, then it gets a little bit more adult content as it goes on. You know, we've got some comedy from Louisville improvisers.
Great. Okay, super. So there are full festival passes for the full 10 days, and there's also day passes available and a full calendar of events at the website?
At the website, slantculture.com. You can find everything there. And if you buy one of those single tickets, you can always trade it. A single ticket is always a coupon.
So. Gotcha.
All right. Teresa Willis and Allison Huff, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Aaron, thanks to you too.
Thanks, Gabe.
And Byline is produced by WFPL News. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For podcasts and more information, visit WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.